oppression of ethnic cleansing, and sort of come to feel that his role could not be to sit on the sidelines, but was to join in and support in whatever way he could, you know, play the role of a supportive activist, support the struggle of Palestinians in the U.S. and, of course, in Palestine. And so he worked very closely with Dima Khalidi to start Palestine Legal, which does fierce and heroic work here in the United States around the question of Palestinian speech rights. It's, you know, that we believe in free speech in this country, but often not around the question of Palestine. And so people who speak up, particularly people who are Palestinian, who speak up for Palestinian rights, end up sort of being silenced in all manner of ways. And so he felt very strongly that sort of the next chapter of his life would be around the issue of Palestine. And he was starting out and embarking on that when he became very sick. But it is beautiful to see the work. It's beautiful to see the work that they're doing at Palestine Legal, and also to see the work that CCR is doing in so many young lawyers who are pushing forward a radical theory of lawyering and also movement building.
I want to thank you all so much for being with us. Lizzie Rettner, niece of the late Michael Rettner, senior editor at The Nation magazine. Vince Warren, Center for Constitutional Rights executive director, and Bahar Azmi, legal director at CCR. The new book, Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
One day.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Join KBOO every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for Counterspin, a show that provides a critical examination of major media stories and exposes what the mainstream media missed. Counterspin exposes and highlights censored stories, sexism, racism, and homophobia in the news, the power of corporate influence, gaffes and goofs by leading TV pundits, and more. That's every Friday at 5:30 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, a Bend man is charged in the murder of Barry Washington Jr. Former Portland Thorns players say they were sexually coerced by a head coach. And Legacy Health will close some area clinics and labs due to vaccine mandate staffing shortages. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 1st, 2021. KBOO is currently in our fall fund drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Sam Bowman. A man in Bend faces murder charges in the shooting death of 22-year-old Barry Washington Jr. Washington was shot by Ian Cranston outside of a nightclub in Bend on September 19th. Cranston is charged with second-degree murder, first-degree manslaughter, second-degree manslaughter, first-degree assault, and two counts of unlawful use of a deadly weapon. Washington, who was black, was unarmed at the time he was shot by Cranston, who was white. John Hummel is the district attorney in Deschutes County. Hummel said the men did not know each other and that Cranston shot Washington after he spoke to Cranston's girlfriend. At a press conference on Thursday, Hummel acknowledged the racial justice advocates in the community who put pressure on the case. Hummel said, quote, "Our country has a disgraceful history of denigrating, prosecuting, and lynching black men for talking to white women. Over the last week, literally hundreds of people called and emailed to remind me of this history. There's a reckoning with race that needs to happen in Central Oregon, and it needs to happen now, end quote. Cranston has not been charged with a bias crime for shooting Washington. He is being held in the Deschutes County Jail without bail. Former Portland Thorns players are speaking out about sexual coercion they faced from former head coach Paul Riley. An article in The Athletic detailed allegations against Riley, including sexual coercion and verbal harassment. Riley has now been fired as head coach of the North Carolina Courage, and all National Women's Soccer League games have been canceled this weekend. Former Portland players Sinead Farrelly and Mana Shim spoke out about the coercion and harassment they endured from Riley. Farrelly says Riley coerced her into sex multiple times. Shim and Farrelly also state that Riley allegedly told them to kiss after a night of heavy drinking, and if they didn't, the team would have to do a grueling conditioning drill the next day. Riley was the head coach of the Portland Thorns from 2013 to 2015. The Thorns didn't renew their contract with him then due to harassment allegations, but didn't state so publicly at the time, and the investigation they did into Riley's behavior didn't prevent him from being hired elsewhere in the league. Riley told The Athletic that the majority of the allegations against him are, quote, completely untrue. The league's Players Association is demanding independent investigation into the allegations, improved reporting of harassment allegations, and protection for players who report it, among other demands. The Oregon Health Authority reports there are now 79 schools with active COVID-19 outbreaks across the state. That's an increase of about 65% from just a week ago. Some schools are reporting more than one outbreak. There are three at North Bend Senior High School involving about 30 kids. Eight more schools have multiple outbreaks, spreading from the Portland area to Southern Oregon. Just yesterday, the state reported more than 2,000 new cases. By far, the most common variant in Oregon has been Delta, with more than 5,800 infections, and Delta Plus racking up another 54. Solitary confinement won't be used as punishment for prisoners in Washington state anymore. Correctional officials say the tactic doesn't deter bad behavior, and other experts say it is harmful to people's mental and physical health. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has the story.
People in custody in Washington state will no longer face solitary confinement, according to state officials who have determined the tactic is not effective. The Washington Department of Corrections made the announcement on Thursday, noting the change in policy has been in place for the last 2 weeks. Corrections Secretary Cheryl Strange says the practice of solitary confinement has been proven to be ineffective in deterring negative behavior and is calling this decision a, quote, key step in becoming a human-centered organization by advancing and improving correctional practices, end quote. Data collected examining the effects of disciplinary segregation, an action that has served as a practice that isolates a person from others while their disciplinary hearing is pending, shows evidence that over 50% of those were perpetrators of nonviolent crimes and that the tactic does not support personal change. A 2018 Southern Poverty Law Center report found that continual use of disciplinary segregation or solitary confinement can be harmful to mental and physical health of the person being held. Further evidence points to the practice as contributing to further complications in rehabilitation, particularly when people face re-entering communities. Washington State Governor Jay Inslee is on board with the decision, saying Thursday, quote, disciplinary segregation has proven to be ineffective in our state correctional facilities, and ending their practice as a form of discipline is the right thing to do. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
The city of Portland announced the location of three new outdoor homeless villages, hoping to bring some relief to the growing houseless crisis that continues to affect the greater Portland area. Three neighborhoods, Downtown, Brentwood-Darlington, and Hazelwood, will soon be home to the first city-sanctioned safe rest villages. Commissioner Dan Ryan is in charge of the effort. It aims to open six safe rest villages by the end of the year. Ryan said during a press conference Thursday these new sites are a, quote, critical response to the humanitarian crisis unfolding on Portland streets. These safe rest villages are outdoor shelters where those experiencing houselessness can camp safely, with basic needs supplied including showers, beds, bathrooms, and access to support services including mental health and personal case management. People who are eligible to camp at the safe rest villages will be based on referrals from community groups, according to Ryan. He hopes the stability provided by the camp spots will eventually lead to permanent housing solutions. The city predicts the three sites will be able to host roughly 120 people and will not consist of tent camps. Each village will be fenced and everyone living there will have their own heated sleeping pod. The specific locations are a plot at the intersection of 122nd and East Burnside at a segment of TriMet's Menlo Park and Ride transit parking area, a previous vacant city-owned lot in the 2300 block of Southwest NATO Parkway, and a city-owned lot at 8330 Southeast 45th Avenue near the Springwater Corridor Trail. Ryan detailed plans for the Safe Rest Village operation last summer. The funding was allotted from a $16 million budget from the American Rescue Plan. The city says that all six Safe Rest Villages will be operational by the end of December. Though exact numbers of people facing houselessness in the greater Portland area are only estimates, at least 60,000 houseless campsites were reported in Portland last year, up from an estimated 40,000 in 2019. A recent analysis ranked Portland as the number one city for vegetarians and vegans out of 100 major U.S. cities. KBOO's Aurora Biggers has more.
In a recent article by Wallet Hub, Wallet Hub ranked Portland, Oregon as the number one vegetarian and vegan-friendly city in the United States. We have Wallet Hub analyst Jill Gonzalez with us to talk about the study. Welcome on, Jill.
Thanks for having me.
In its study, Wallet Hub ranked 100 U.S. cities, placing Portland as number one for vegetarian and vegan-friendly. Can you tell us how Wallet Hub determined its data for what makes a city vegan and vegetarian-friendly?
So to determine the best and the cheapest places for a plant-based diet, we actually looked at 16 different indicators of vegan and vegetarian-friendliness. So we examined each city based on metrics like the cost of groceries for vegetarians, the share of restaurants serving meatless options, and things like salad shops per capita. So not only vegetarian lifestyle, but the access to it, the quality of it, and the affordability of it.
Portland's overall score is 63.52, according to the study, a combination of, like you said, affordability, diversity, accessibility, quality, and vegetarian lifestyle scores. A perfect score, if I understand it correctly, would be 100 points. So it seems like there is some room for improvement for Portland. What do you think Portland could do in the future to increase its vegetarian and vegan-friendly score?
Well, Portland, it really comes down to affordability. So it ranked number one overall, top 10 for the other two categories. But for affordability, it ranked 29. So out of 100, that is still better than average. But I think you'll notice it when you especially go out to eat, or even the cost of groceries you see are a little bit higher. And part of that is shipping to the West Coast. Part of that is Portland having a little bit higher of a cost of living than some of these other cities to begin with.
One of the things that you note in this analysis is that the price of synthetic vegan meat has decreased during the pandemic. Can you tell us why we would be seeing this shift?
So being vegan or vegetarian tends to be a little bit more expensive, but even that's becoming less of a problem. So the price of plant-based meat substitutes has actually come down considerably during the COVID-19 pandemic, and a lot of that is due in part to difficulties at meatpacking plants and advances just in the technology used to create that synthetic meat. So the combination of those two things over the past year or so has led to a drop in those prices.
For anyone who's just now listening, we're speaking with Jill Gonzalez, analyst for Wallet Hub, about why Portland is 2021's best city for vegetarians and vegans. Thank you, Jill, for talking with us today. If our listeners have any additional questions, where can they get more information about this subject?
Head to wallethub.com. You'll find where every city is ranked, not just Portland, and look for 2021's best cities for vegans and vegetarians.
That was analyst Jill Gonzalez from Wallet Hub. And for KBOO News, I'm Aurora Biggers.
You are listening to a special fall fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can become a member or renew your KBOO membership at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines. At 6, it's our Hispanic and Latinx Month special programming. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 71. Today in history, in 1890, Yosemite National Park was established by the U.S. Congress. It is one of the largest and least fragmented habitat blocks in the Sierra Nevada, and the desire to protect it was central to the development of the national park idea. The quote of the day is from American author E.B. White, who died this day in 1985. He said, quote, "I arise in the morning, torn between a desire to improve the world and a desire to enjoy the world. This makes it hard to plan the day." End quote. Congress is debating the Build Back Better Act, legislation that would make sweeping investments across the country. That includes provisions that would significantly cut down on child hunger. It also includes a push to electrify home appliances and make infrastructure more climate-friendly. Eric Tegedoff has more on the benefits of the program in the Pacific Northwest.
Groups fighting child hunger say the Build Back Better Act in Congress could be a once-in-a-generation opportunity to cut down on the number of kids going hungry. The budget reconciliation package currently being debated in Washington, D.C., includes a provision to expand eligibility for school meals. Chloe Eberhardt with Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon says it provides a pathway to making school meals universal in Oregon.
That really is something that we've been investing in Oregon pre-pandemic, because we know the value and the importance of school meals for addressing hunger for kids. And so this really is validation to that.
The Build Back Better Act also increases access to meals during the summer months when hunger spikes for kids. The legislation is receiving pushback, including from some moderate Democrats, because of its cost, which currently exceeds $3 trillion. Susanna Morgan heads Oregon Food Bank and says the budget package includes key provisions that will cut down on disparities across the board, such as universal preschool. She says one of the most important anti-poverty pieces is making permanent the child tax credit, which has gone out to families during the pandemic. The credit provides up to $3,600 a year to families, depending on the age of their child, and phasing out for households with higher incomes.
Research has shown that in the months that it has existed, it's cutting child poverty in half. It's lifting families with small children out of poverty, which is absolutely astonishing and delighting.
While there is an urge to return to life pre-pandemic, Eberhardt says hunger was a major issue before COVID-19. 1 in 10 Oregonians struggled to put food on the table, according to the Oregon Hunger Task Force. She notes rates were twice as high for Black, Indigenous, and people of color.
The Build Back Better Act, really, for us, is getting right at that, because we don't want to go back to what was the normal before the pandemic, because that wasn't working.
Proposals in Congress's Build Back Better Act could speed up and lower the cost of electrifying people's homes. The budget reconciliation package, currently in front of lawmakers in Washington, D.C., aims to take major climate action. The current plan includes $18 billion in rebates to help people afford electric appliances and fund energy-saving retrofits in their homes. Melissa Hughes with the Thurston Climate Action Team in Olympia says the needed changes to make infrastructure more climate-friendly are costly.
To do the retrofits and weatherization that's needed, just in Thurston County alone, we're looking at probably a need of $2 billion, which of course isn't easy to come up with. So the federal funding, when it comes through, is a pretty sizable amount.
$9 billion in the bill go to rebates for home electrification, with $5.5 billion dedicated to households with low to moderate incomes. Mark Kresiewicz is with the Carbon Free Buildings Program at RMI, a nonprofit pushing for clean energy. He says rebates in the bill reach up to $14,000 to electrify appliances such as heat pumps. Kresiewicz notes a large number of low to moderate income families have gas infrastructure in their homes right now.
26 million households burning fossil fuels inside their homes right now. Burning gas and other fossil fuels inside your home causes tremendous health problems. It's contributing to climate disruption, and it's costing families far more money than they need to be paying for energy.
Kreswick believes there are many upsides to electrifying appliances in the home.
These superior electric appliances like heat pumps and induction stoves can lower costs, save lives, increase jobs, and provide more comfortable, affordable homes for everyone.
Another component of the bill dedicates $20 billion to electrification, efficiency, and health and safety repairs in the affordable and multifamily housing sectors. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Senate votes to fund the government and avoid a shutdown, and the Biden administration issues new rules on immigration arrests. With those stories and more, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
On this vote, the yeas are 65, the nays are 35. The 60-vote threshold having been achieved, the bill is passed.
The Senate passed a bill Thursday to fund the government, narrowly avoiding a midnight shutdown. Senators voted to fund the government through December 3rd, as well as provide emergency funding for disaster relief related to recent hurricanes, severe storms, and western wildfires, and for Afghan refugee relocation. The issue of raising the nation's debt ceiling will be back on the table near the end of the year, with Republicans lining up to oppose it again, as Democrats work to pass the president's infrastructure, social safety net, and tax proposals. The CDC has issued its strongest recommendation yet for pregnant people to get vaccinated. The guidance comes as the agency reports that through September 27th, there were more than 125,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in pregnant women. More than 22,000 people were hospitalized and 161 died. Chief Medical Advisor to the President, Dr. Anthony Fauci, says women with symptomatic coronavirus cases have a higher risk of admission into intensive care and a 70% increased risk of death.
What we need to do is to make sure we protect women and protect their unborn child.
Facebook's global head of safety director, Antigone Davis, defended the company's practices for protecting children at a Thursday hearing on Capitol Hill, as some lawmakers accused Facebook of exploiting the well-being of children for advertising revenue.
We've built AI to identify suicide content on our platform and rapidly respond with resources. We've launched tools to help control time spent on our apps.
The Biden administration published new rules Thursday governing immigration arrests across the country, directing U.S. officials to focus on detaining and deporting immigrants determined to pose a threat to national security or public safety, as well as migrants who recently crossed the southern border. Experts say the policy will likely spare most undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. from deportation as long as they don't commit serious crimes. Meanwhile, Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson announced Greyhound will pay $2.2 million to individual customers to settle a lawsuit filed by the state over the company's practice of allowing U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents to board and search its buses without warrants. And in Boston, more than a dozen doctors protested outside the home of Moderna's CEO over the company's refusal to give up intellectual property related to its COVID-19 vaccine. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Groups across the Midwest raised awareness of the lasting impacts of Indian boarding schools. And the Canadian government loses its appeal over Native child welfare. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Several events were held in the Midwest for the National Day of Remembrance for Indian Boarding Schools. Rhonda Lovaldo has the story.
Haskell Indian Nations University students organized an Orange Shirt Day of Remembrance for Indian boarding schools with a walk and a presentation. Student Government Vice President Ismael Osigueda wanted to make sure his fellow peers learn about the beginnings of Haskell.
Bring to their awareness of like what the history of the school is, you know, just everything behind it, because I know like personally I didn't know as much as I do now, you know, and just trying to do our best just to bring the awareness so that way kids understand what going on here and what the past was about.
With the cemetery on the school grounds, Haskell student Timothy Denego explained how that affects students.
They have a cemetery back there for all, the kids that passed on, and
who knows how many other kids that haven't been found yet. You know, that's one of the key things to keep in mind is that, you know, those are only the ones that have been reported and confirmed. So, you know, there's not confirmed of others that are yet to be found. You know, it's like those are our ancestors, you know, ancestors, our grandmas, grandparents, great-grandparents, you know, down the line.
The Kansas City Indian Center also held a remembrance event at a park in Olathe, Kansas. Their executive director, Gaylene Krauser, says she thinks it's a good start to informing the public of what happened.
Just bringing community together and talking about it and getting some ways that they can start to heal and also bring additional awareness. You know, the more of us that are working towards that goal, better off we'll be.
The chief of the Shawnee tribe, Ben Barnes, also held a press conference in Kansas at the Shawnee Mission Indian School site to ask for federal investigations into residential schools with the help of local Kansas leaders. This is Rhonda Lovaldo for National Native News.
The Canadian government has lost an appeal over providing services and compensation to First Nations children. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the Federal Court of Canada dismissed Ottawa's bid to appeal two rulings.
One of the appeals was to a 2019 Canadian Human Rights Tribunal ruling that said the Canadian government did not properly fund child and family services, and that resulted in willful and reckless discrimination against Indigenous children living on reserves. The tribunal ordered Ottawa to pay $40,000 each to about 50,000 First Nations children and their relatives. The second appeal referred to a 2020 ruling over Jordan's principle, which stated that when there's jurisdictional disagreement over which level of government should provide for First Nations children, the federal government takes the responsibility. Cindy Blackstock is the executive director of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society of Canada.
This decision means that First Nations children Auk Reserve can get the help they need to recover from the trauma of residential schools through Jordan's principle. And it also means that Canada's many and ongoing victims of its discriminatory underfunding of children's services can get compensated to a value of $40,000 each.
The federal court judge in his decision said there's no question First Nations are among the most disadvantaged and marginalized people in Canadian society. The Human Rights Tribunal was aware of this and reasonably attempted to remedy the discrimination. He also found that the government failed to establish that either of the tribunal's decisions were unreasonable. Indigenous leaders had criticized Ottawa's decision to appeal, saying it was not the course that a government committed to reconciliation would take. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Federal officials, U.S. lawmakers, and healthcare experts are among speakers to discuss tribal issues next week at the National Indian Health Board's virtual conference. COVID-19, funding, and boarding schools are among topics. Federal consultation and listening sessions will also take place. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to a special fall fund drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 1st, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking story tip at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Aurora Biggers and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Nadia Ramlagan, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is in our fall fun drive, which means that now is a great time to become a member and support your local community radio station. If you would like to contribute to KBOO, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, crime wave politics are a time-honored response to political